thank you very much for coming. Firstly, I wish to dedicate this lecture to recital to the person that I dedicated my thesis to, and that's my mum, Maureen Frances Cape. Now, this recital really is about, well, actually my thesis really is about two great people that I first came to know in my first year at the Royal College of Music back in 1995. The first one was Ralph Vaughan Williams. And what blew me away, literally, about Vaughan Williams was we had to do a performance of the Sea Symphony, which is his first symphony, at the concert hall of the Royal College. Now, in the Royal College of Music, there are paintings on all walls, all sides of the walls, of the great composers who went there. Benjamin Britten, Michael Tippett, Ralph Vaughan Williams, you name it, they're all there. And we sang the Sea Symphony. I didn't know who Vaughan Williams was, and the first couple of chords that start off in the brass herald the words "Behold the Sea," which are words by Walt Whitman, and literally blew me away. And I sort of fell in love with Vaughan Williams, and I've remained a great admirer of his work. The same year, a friend of mine gave me a book about Lionel Tertius. Now, I'd only been playing the viola for about 3 years, so I didn't know much about the repertoire or about the viola at all. So I read about Lionel Tertius and sort of grew to know this person. So basically, this is what the thesis is about: Ralph Vaughan Williams and Lionel Tertius and their collaboration for this great work, which is the suite for viola and orchestra, or piano. I wanted to start off by giving you a bit of background about Vaughan Williams, first of all. Now, Vaughan Williams himself started on the viola, but his parents didn't think that the viola was suitable. Rather, his family didn't think it was suitable for a person of his nobility. Interestingly enough, his great-uncle was Charles Darwin, and his father was a vicar. Now, his father died when he was only 4 years of age, so he had a lot of divisions from early childhood. Apparently, he said to his mother, "Mummy, what is, you know, Daddy says one thing about God and Uncle Charles says another." And apparently the mum said, "Well, you know, they're both right in their own sort of way." And that's how Vaughan Williams started his life. So he started the viola, switched to organ, and from an early age, he showed a good promise as a composer. So in 1890, he went to the Royal College of Music and studied with Perry. Then he went to Trinity College, Cambridge, where he earned 2 degrees, a Bachelor of Music in 1894 and a Bachelor of History in 1895. Now, whilst he was at Trinity, this is another interesting thing I found out, he befriended Bertrand Russell, who was there at the time, a great philosopher, and it was he who introduced Vaughan Williams to the work of Walt Whitman. So that was an interesting thing I found out as well. Later on, he studied in Berlin in 1897 with Max Bruch, and after that in Paris in 1908 with Maurice Ravel. So his education was quite something else. From very on in his works, he obviously shows great love for the viola. He himself, as I said, played the viola. And in earlier works, for instance, in 1910, we have the Fantasia on the theme of Thomas Tallis, which has a very elaborate viola solo in the work. And he wrote a fantasy quintet later on in 1912, which has 2 violins, 2 violas, and a cello. And a lot of voicing is given to the first viola, so he really pulls out the themes there. And then another interesting piece that I discovered or found out about is the 4 hymns for tenor, viola, and piano. And they were premiered in 1925 in my hometown of Cardiff, so I was quite elated to hear that. Other works, again, that feature the viola include the London Symphony in 1914 and the Slow Movement, very beautiful viola solo, and Flos Campi of 1925. Now, regarding Flos Campi, it wasn't written for Tertius, but it is dedicated to him. Now, it's an interesting work in that there's a solo viola, orchestra, and a voiceless choir, and the work is based around the Song of Solomon. There's a quote here from Michael Kennedy. Now, Michael Kennedy is a very well-established and very well-known music critic in the British Isles, and he says this: "Ralph had 2 works for strings in hand, a violin concerto for Gelli d'Andry and a viola piece to add to the very limited repertory that existed for the instrument. He had taken a literary idea on which to build his musical thought in the Lark Ascending and made his violin become the bird song and its flight being, rather than illustrating, the poem from which the title was taken. So in Flos Campi, words were the starting point, episodes from the song, the songs. The viola, with its capability of warmth and its glowing quality, was the instrument he knew best. And it's absolutely right. So that was the first collaboration we have. I've, on the sort of handout I gave you there, that's a picture from 1958, not too long before Vaughan Williams died, but that is, Vaughan Williams is there, and his wife Ursula is next to him, and Tertius is in the foreground, and they're discussing a performance of Flos Campi. So that's Vaughan Williams and his association with the viola. Now Tertius, as I said, I had this book given to me from a good friend, and I started reading it, and I just thought it was absolutely hilarious, because not only did the man live for 98 years, every single one of those years he fought for the right to have works written for the viola. He himself studied as a pianist, started off in 1893 at Trinity College of Music, and then he went to the Leipzig Conservatory, and then later on in 1895 he went to the Royal Academy of Music in London. Now, I got a quotation about this thing from him. Yes. Now, from the very onset, when he discovered the viola, he decided that was the instrument for him. When I first began to play the viola as a solo instrument, prejudice and storms of abuse were my lot. The consensus of opinion was that the viola had no right to be heard in solos. Indeed, the consideration of its place in the string family was of the scantiest. A wretchedly low standard of viola playing was in fact accepted simply and solely because there was no alternative. This is what he writes in his autobiography, My Viola and I. A little old man, said to be a professional viola player, was engaged by the academy to take part twice a week in the orchestral practices. What a player he was! He used a very small instrument, not worthy of the name viola, and he produced from it as ugly as a sound as fiddle ever emitted. A bone-dry tone, absolutely devoid of vibrato, which made one's hair stand on end. I once inquired of Sir Alexander, could we not dispense with this horrible player? His reply was, no, he is a necessary evil. So the viola, at the point, was not regarded as such a great instrument. Oh, right. 1906, he joined the Bohemian String Quartet. Now, the Bohemian String Quartet was famous for having works written for them, including the Janáček and Dvořák string quartets. And then in 1909, he decided to stop playing with orchestras and chamber music and concentrate solely on the viola. Oh, in 1911, he first performs the Chaconne. The Chaconne is a work that was written set in party to the violin and for solo violin, the movement of which is one of the most fiendishly difficult for actual solo violin, and he arranged it for viola. And he was the first to do this, and apparently that wasn't taken lightly either. As a quote from a letter he wrote to Edwin Evans. Dear Mr. Evans, I can't thank you sufficiently for your article in the Atlantic. It is so understanding and fully realizes the shameful neglect of the viola as a solo instrument. The concert has been so disgracefully treated as far as the press is concerned. This is the concert where he played the Chaconne. I suppose if I had come from Bulgaria or some other foreign country with an unpronounceable name, they would take more interest in it. Surely they know by this time that my aim is and object is not for my own personal prestige in any way, but solely and purely for the furtherance of the claims of the viola as a solo instrument. So right from the beginning, Tertius is battling for the viola. Vaughan Williams loves the viola, and this is where we get the actual suite. That's a combination of the works. So I wanted to talk about that. First of all, a bit about Tertius's style of viola playing, because in his autobiography as well, he produced a treatise
which stated how he thought about playing the instrument. We'll notice that I'm going to play a recording in a moment of his performance of the chaton, how he likes to have a very broad sort of sound, a very broad style of playing. He really wants the instrument to sing. And in his autobiography, Mayo Viola and I, he suggests that one should probe into, using your musicality to the utmost, tone graduation, accents, rhythm, or even alteration of phrasing, etc., all of which relieve the monotony and lend colour and expressiveness to your efforts. Do not feel absolutely bound to abide by all the printed nuances you find in the work you are playing. An alteration here and there that really appeals to you is not a crime and will provide a change from other interpretations and show your own individuality. And that's going to come into play because the whole thesis is about how he made changes to the manuscript of the suite. So, that same. This is what other people, again, thought of Tertius's playing. Outstanding in Tertius's playing of the sonata, the autumnal music, lonely and strong, had always accurate intonation, the foundation of Tertius's musical strength, the constant true vibrato, always alive and disciplined, never obtrusive, the sheer range of tone colours. This tonal range, allied to an instinctively aristocratic sense of broad, natural phrasing, gives Tertius's playing its unique and daring qualities. It's like listening to a great singer. So again, as I said, we're going to have a few examples later on about how what he's changed from the manuscript into how his edition 1936 really reflects this sort of style. So I wanted to play for a moment the excerpt of the chaton. First of all, I want to just give you a little sample of another great string player of the 20th century, that's Jascha Heifetz. Just going to give you a little sample of how he plays the chaton. phrasing is a lot more line, there's a lot more tenuto, held sound quality. Now I wanted to draw your attention to the first example there. So as you can see, what we have in the original, no markings at all, but pay attention to what Tertius does. You'll see that all the notes from bar 53 onwards have tenuto markings over them, these lines, which enables him to sort of get into the string and have that really held sort of quality. Okay, sort of play for me. I'll mention when it comes up. See an example too is that he's got the pianissimo and then the phrase mark with the tenuto mark over the forte, so he's got a big loud sound and a big contrast there. That was what I was trying to demonstrate there, because that comes in a lot in his edition. And then we'll go on to the next one. Additions. Now, getting back to the actual suite itself, there is The amount of the manuscript that's held in the British Library and the 1936 edition that Tertius edited, there's a lot of differences. In fact, I counted out there are 261 changes between the manuscript and the actual edition. Now, out of those 261 changes, 185 are related to articulation and to phrasing. So in other words, those two examples that we just heard, the slurs and the actual tenuto mark, etc. So that's 71% of the changes made to do with articulation and phrasing. I want to point out as well that when I first sort of got into this project, I didn't know who was the actual editor of the work, because usually on the front page, you'd have it would say, you know, whoever composed the work, it would say edited by so and so so and so, but it didn't say Lionel Tertius. So I was a bit upset. So I wrote off to Oxford University Press and I asked them if they knew by chance if the work was indeed edited by Tertius. And I had a reply back saying that we've looked through the file of the work and there's no mention of Tertius at all. So I was a bit upset because I thought, well, that's the end of my thesis. So I really couldn't understand, because all the other editions I'd found of different works, like the Chacon,
other works that he'd arranged, they all look very similar. They had these articulation and phrasing, it all looked like they had the fingerprints of Tertius. So eventually, I did go to Oxford and actually spoke to the lady there and asked if I could actually physically look at the file that she gave it to me. And as I flipped through it, you've got the two letters that are actually here as well. It says, many thanks for your letter. This is the first one. I've been through the score and marked obvious corrections, etc. And the piano version is more reliable, I feel. I went through the work with VW and LT at VW's Dorking House. VW obviously being Vaughan Williams and LT being Lionel Tertius. Now, this is obviously why this lady said, well, there's no mention of them, because it's their acronyms of their names, they're not actual names. And it says, regarding the viola part, there's a question whether to keep the version given or whether we scrap this and substitute the Lionel Tertius version already published. And the reply to that letter is Bernard Shaw is another violist of the time, had our tete-a-tete Wednesday and came to the conclusion that the viola solo part as printed in the piano score is the authentic one and you should incorporate it to replace the one you adopted from the manuscript you sent me, which is so completely different in bowing, phrasing and dynamics. So bingo, I was very happy to sort of get that. I had to write it down, and that's a part of the thesis. So we have the two major things, articulation and phrasing. And so the next example, I'm going to ask if Rachel is there, she can join me, please. Rachel? And we're just going to play you the examples that we have that I wrote down. So the first one, articulation. I'm going to demonstrate what is in the score and then what Tertius wrote as his addition. And hopefully you'll notice that the idea of getting bigger sound and accents in louder sort of passages and sort of more cantabile, sort of slower bow strokes, etc., in quieter passages becomes apparent. So this is the first example. This is the actual opening. Tertius, in the original version, which is with the orchestra, really wants the viola to be heard over the orchestra and adds accents and more broader sound to really get the actual sound of the instrument ringing. And this is his 1936 edition. Broader sound, very reminiscent of his version of the Chopin. In example number four, we have the same idea, this time a sort of almost inversion of the opening thing, and this is what the composer is in the manuscript. Being the elaborate
fellow that he was. Again, adds the accents. And you'll notice towards the end of this passage, the 1936 edition, he's put a couple of slurs in there, which enable the bow to really reach towards that forte crescendo climax. So this is Tertius's version. There as well. In example 5, we have there were many other instances where also Tertius would change the dynamic, trying to highlight a certain event or climax. Now you'll notice bar 3 of this excerpt in the score, there's a diminuendo, and the phrasing is such that you have slurs over most of the notes. Which produces this sort of effect. I'm just going to play from bar 3 onwards. Now, Tertius's version, he removes those slurs and he adds the tenuto marks, even puts in fingering, which would actually make you jump around, shift around, and he retains the dynamic, so you have more of a boisterous, big sound reminiscent of his own. So basically he's done it again with his alteration thing. Now, phrasing, and that's the idea of slurs, etc., going over. In the next example, example 6, in the manuscript, we have this. This is from the Christmas dance. And instead of the 3-4 sort of feel, it's sort of chopped. The phrase is chopped up, and Tertius has changed it somewhat. So this is the first. This is how the manuscript. Tertius changes the bowing to have a more of a dance-like feel and to create a bigger phrase that he always looks after, looks for. Now there's another quote in when Tertius talks about actual playing, etc. He always has these quotes that talk about how to keep a bow on the string, a tenuto sound, a big sound. He was always after a bigger sound from the viola because of the way that the viola is built. It should be bigger than it is, but it's smaller. It should be physically half the size of a cello, which would make it impossible to sort of play this way and a bit tricky to play the other way. So he eventually created an instrument that he thought would actually proved to be a great viola, because he was always after this great viola sound. But also he writes this one particular quotation: the ethereal sound of a passage played pianissimo by a slow clinging bow can be exquisite. And this is the passage from the ballad, it's towards the end, actually the very end of the ballad, and this is how the manuscript's right. So at the very end there are two different bows from this which change on the suspension, and Tertius actually ties it in, but this is how the manuscript. Now, as ethereal as that is, that change on the suspension is quite abrupt. So Tertius ties that entire suspension right at the end. So he would always go on about how you have to have a really slow bow stroke to get that ethereal heavenly quality, and this is what he writes. Another example of Tertius changing the music from the manuscript to his edition in order to create a more beautiful dolce cantabile style of playing occurs right at the end of the Polka Melancholica as a cadenza. In the manuscript, it's written quite differently indeed. As you'll see, all the notes there, apart from the first one, are split. So in other words, they have rapid up bows and down bows. And that effect sounds thus. Tertius changes it to be again more ethereal, more song-like. Another example of his wanting to have beautiful sound in a quieter passage. So basically, again, reiterating what I said, in the louder passages he wants to be heard, he likes to get the viola across the orchestra. In the quieter ones, he likes to use more of the bow, in the same way as a singer would use a phrase and sing really delicately and add that absolute magnificent quality of just grabbing one's audience. Just going to come to the last couple of excerpts. This one was very interesting in the Gallop because, as you see in example 9a, in the manuscript you have those staccato marks marked all over those notes, and you have a very curious bar 4, which I can hardly play because it's a bit odd how the bowing is marked in there. It's a sort of bar 3. It's very difficult to sort of pull that one off, but I'll try and do what we have. This is what the manuscript writes. Yeah, I can't even play that. But what Tertius does in the fourth bar is that because we have this we have that hemiola. He's changed the bowing, he's puts accents on it, and he also ties in the first couple of notes, the first couple of bars, and so it sounds a bit smoother, a bit more like this. Now, I forgot to mention these parts earlier, but whilst I was researching, in addition to the letters that I found at Oxford, I found two copies that he actually used, and these were at Trinity College in Greenwich in London. And again, it was a little sort of a gold chase, I suppose, or gold treasure, that's what I'm looking for. And there were the two copies, and there were additional markings marked within these copies that sort of substantiate the claims that I made earlier about him using broader sound in passages of louder quality, and longer phrases in quieter passages. And you will see that he's done exactly that with this passage, that he's actually connected those last couple of bars there with a huge phrase. So having really a more sort of a quieter approach to really get you going. And that sounds a bit like this. So that was also in those parts, that I should have mentioned, there were many additional words that he threw in, like sost, which means sostenuto, means to hold, to sustain, and more, bigger, broader. They're all in the back of my thesis. This huge table that I've compiled has every single addition that he put. So basically, we have a work, as I said, that
combines Vaughan Williams with Tertius, and one that really reflects the greatness of the two different composers. I really think that this particular work isn't played as much as it should be, and I think Vaughan Williams' work isn't performed as much as it should be. I think it's going to have a big resurgence. I know particularly that I want to sort of follow Tertius' vein, what he did in sort of get promoting music for the viola. It'd be great to sort of take it around and just say, well, you know, Cinderella no more. This is a great instrument. As I said, when I started off this project, I had Vaughan Williams really in mind. I didn't really think about Tertius as such, but as I progressed with my quest, it almost seemed as if Tertius was dragging me in, saying, no, I want you to do, you know, this is, you've got to do this for the viola. Because originally I was thinking of doing an original, authentic version of the suite and how the composer wanted it to be. But then I realized that, you know, Vaughan Williams sanctioned Tertius's edition, and they obviously were great friends, and they produced this great work, which is the suite for viola and orchestra. And I hope that you'll enjoy it when I come back to play it. Thank you very much.